in our day, the meaning of what it is to be human is one of the greatest questions before our civilization, our culture. And it is one to which only the Christian has a true answer and a foundation for it. I want to quote to you a quote that we will parse as we exposit Genesis 1. It is the reflection on Genesis 1 of a rather remarkable man. And we will get to meet him in March, hopefully, as we have our conference for the Granite State School on biotechnology and ethics. And I want you to be praying about that, because I believe it could be a significant entrance into the lives of some of our fellow Manchester citizens if they are interested in this question. And they ought to be, and we hope to make people interested. But Leon Cass is the chairman of the President's Commission on Bioethics, and in fact has produced two of the best books that have ever been produced by the United States government. They are truly remarkable as they defend, they ask the right questions, all of them, and in very profound and detailed ways, and they give some profound direction. Now, of course, he cannot preach the gospel in a government document, but he comes about as close as you could get to showing us the need to go back to the scriptures. And this is what he says. This is just a little quote, what he says about human dignity. Human dignity associated with the new biology, that is biotechnology, and its underlying anthropology is inhuman, because it dualistically sets up the concept of personhood in opposition to nature and the body, and thus fails to do justice to the concrete reality of our embodied lives, and pays no respect at all to the dignity we have through our loves and longings, central aspects of human life understood as grown togetherness of body and soul. That's a profound statement, and I can send you the whole essay that comes from if you request it of me. Let's turn now to Genesis chapter 1, and I'm going to read the brief portion of the text in Genesis 1 that we will unpack this morning. Genesis 1, and now beginning where we left off last Lord's Day in our exposition at verse 26. Remember, we're in the middle of the sixth day, and now, having created all else in the universe, and particularly on the earth as the habitat of man, now this. Then God said, "Let us make man in our own image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given you every green herb for food." And it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. We see here the clearest statement that out of the dust of the earth, and we'll get to that more in detail in the second chapter, but we know from that, out of the dust of the earth, he created man in an instant to be what he is. There's clearly no evolutionary process here either referred to or possible in this creation account. We must be clear on that. We said last week that the length of the days is not a question that we can definitively answer from the text, because indeed these definite periods of time are utterly unique in what is happening. And we also say, and these two don't contradict one another, that whatever the length of those days, we are not talking about evolution here. We are talking about God forming out of the clay of the earth man and making him in his own image, male and female. He created them. God created man. And that's our first point here as we look at this text and seek to unpack it this morning. And I want you to also be aware, and here, if I could only read the Hebrew to you, and all my homiletics professors told me don't ever do that in a sermon, so I won't. But there's poetry here. And in fact, here is the first true poetry in the Bible. And what you'll notice in these verses, and remember that the verse markers are like the coordinates on a map. They were added later to help us find our way around. Forget about them for a moment. And look at that text. And you'll see that there are two things that he repeats three times. Moses repeats three times. And remember what we said about the days of creation, that there are these two panels that relate to one another. Days 1 to 3, days 4 to 6. One is the habitations, the other is those that will be the inhabitants. And of course, the crowning inhabitant of the whole habitation is man on the sixth day. And now we have here God saying, we will make man in our own image. Image, image, and God created. And those are the two words that are repeated six times, three each. And there's not an accident in this. And I'm going to be making this case throughout the preaching of the book of Genesis that the Bible, whether it's history or whether it's poetry, whether it's wisdom literature, no matter what it is, has artistry because God inspired it. And we mustn't be afraid of that. We must embrace it because that's the way God is, and because he is a God not only who created numbers and science and enabled us to unpack some of the mysteries of the universe and use them for good, but he also gave us mystery and wonder and beauty and order and patterns in his world and in his word. And so we see that pattern, and what it does is it accentuates in a very powerful way that God, out of nothing, created man in his image in order to be an underlord, to have dominion over everything. He made us utterly unique. In our generation, having been taught and saturated with evolutionary scientistic doctrines, not really true science in so many ways, has imbibed the idea that we are nothing but highly developed animals. And it should not be a surprise then when we begin to behave like animals and we begin to treat the value of human life as if we were only animals. In fact, animals are valuable, and we'll see in a moment that ecology ought to be something that we as Christians are supremely interested in because God created everything and gave us stewardship of all things. Now, there's been a great question here, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, of what it means, let us make man in our image. The first suggestion, of course, is that it's the plural of majesty. And we said that Elohim, the word for God, is in fact a plural of majesty, which emphasizes the august greatness of God. Okay, and we know from the rest of the Bible that that means also that he is Trinity, though that is not explicit in that plural. It is emphasizing the greatness of God. Now, some have said it must be the plural of majesty, but we have a pronoun here, us. And so never in Hebrew, as that I'm aware, is the word us used with reference to that plural of majesty. We're talking near about a plural of beings. And so what is that plural of beings? Some have said that it is actually the council of angels that we know were created in the heavenly courtroom. And there are places in the Bible where it's clear that God is including the angelic hosts in His counseling activity as sovereign. But remember, He's called His creatures to be partners with Him in the subduing of the world. But I have a problem. I can't get over the fact that here the our, the us, is the one that creates. And angels do not create. And so while I respect that position, I have to come out where I think most commentators have to say that this is the triune God. And again, the Trinity, three persons, is not explicit here, but it is clearly implied. And the us is the divine counsel of the three persons. And I believe that this is also unique and reminds us, along with the poetry of these verses, that we are unique. He says this of no other created being. There's no consultation. There is no counsel of eternity in the same way that there is with reference to the creating of mankind. And so, man then is the imago Dei. That's a Latin phrase that simply means the image of God. And you see it, I mention it, because it's in all of the literature. The imago. It's a wonderful word. And it's a word which we ought to be able to unpack for people. What does it mean? What does it mean that we are made in the image and likeness of God? Incidentally, some have tried to make theologies of man out of those two words, image and likeness. If you understand Hebrew poetry and literature, it's a poetic parallelism simply emphasizing the fact. They do mean different things. Image actually refers to something carved or molded or cut. And likeness simply means something similar. But it's a parallelism. We don't want to create a theology around a distinction between those two words. Moses is emphasizing what this image is. A likeness to God. That is to say that he has cut and molded a being which is like him. Separate from him. Different because we have a beginning and an end and because we are limited as creatures. But like him. Remarkably like him. Now notice that we also have some similarity with the animals. We have flesh. We have physical bodies. We eat some of the same things, because we also eat them. But we are creatures of dust, and so we share some things. And we've looked, if you look at the various systems, our physical systems, they bear resemblance to many, especially in the mammal kingdom. But what's accentuated here is not that similarity, but the utter uniqueness of man as the image of God. And so what does it mean? Now, some people have said we have the image. And I would want to say, no, that's not quite the right way of saying it. Because, in fact, we may run afoul of the very danger that Leon Cass pointed out in that quote of separating the physical from the spiritual in man. And that's precisely what we must not do. We visited Marge, who is largely unconscious in a hospital. Her disease-racked body lying there in the bed, hardly able to communicate. What do we think of her? Do we think, well, if now her body is dead, there's no Marge? Well, we might think of the other way around, that we define the personality so that if there's no possibility of thought, they're not human. But the Bible teaches us that body and soul go together, and we must never separate the two, because it is body and soul that the Lord tells us images Him. It's amazing. And in fact, as I look at your faces, one of the things that is unique about the image of God is that we have faces. And no other creature, I can look into little Buster's eyes and I do not see the image of God. There are some things about Buster, that's our kitty cat, that remind me of God. And in all creatures reveal Him. We know that. That's what we just sang. But there's something about a human face. There is an intelligence and there is a heavenward bent. There is something utterly unique that's communicated, and we communicate through faces, don't we? You can tell. I remember sometimes our kids, when they were teenagers especially, they'd see our face and they'd go, "What's that look for? What's that face for?" And animals cannot do that. And so we are uniquely communicative beings. And we know that imaging the Trinity, that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit have communicated among themselves in all eternity in a profound way, and that we are there made like that, so that we communicate within ourselves, that's unique to us as human beings, and we communicate with one another. And most importantly, we commune and communicate with heaven. And the fact that we are upright, I believe, in our bodies, there is indeed a dignity to the human frame even, as well as the face, that shows that we have a heavenward connection, that we were made to have communion with heaven, to traverse that ladder of Jacob, which is filled with angelic mystery. That's what we're meant to do. And think of it then. Think of how undignified and inhuman, as Cass says it is, then, not to accept this biblical understanding of mankind. And I believe it's one of the great apologetic tools that we must, and we're not doing this very well, but we must do. We must take advantage of it to show, to talk about, with people about the fact that their view of mankind, their anthropology, has everything to do with the way our culture is moving. And that they have an instinct made in God's image, even if they don't acknowledge it, that there's something wrong with that. Because, of course, there's something wrong with them, as with us. It's called sin. And so there is this natural communion, then, with God that is our bent. It's reflected in body and soul. That is to say that we are worshipful creatures. We are worshipful. We are meant. We are created to bow before God and to say, "Oh Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You are God and we are your creatures, given the joyful task of dominion in your world." That's what we were made to be. And so while it may seem that we are out of sorts with the rest of culture, which we are, it is really the rest of culture that is out of sorts with God and what they are by nature, as made in His image. Now we'll look in more detail about the differences there in terms of what has changed and what has not changed because of sin. We'll look at that when we get into chapters 2 and 3. But also notice that man is a social being. He created. He doesn't go into this in detail now until chapter 2, as he begins to focus now on the garden situation. But male and female, we are made to be social beings. We are made to commune on a personal level with other people. There are no hermits in the Bible. It's certainly not an ideal. And then we are ethical. We have consciences. Unlike little Buster who goes and eats birds, he obviously doesn't have a conscience. But we do. We know right from wrong. I'm not saying it's wrong for him to eat birds, by the way, but we know right from wrong. We know selfishness from love. Even sinners who don't know the Lord know in their heart of hearts what right and wrong is. Their conscience is either excusing or accusing them. That's what Paul teaches in Romans 2. It's clear. We have a sense of right and wrong that no other creature on earth does. And as well. And here's one that we often miss. I think it's because we live in a technological society. Our aesthetic natures, that we recognize beauty. It's not only in the eye of the beholder. That, in fact, is a thesis I'd like to take up at some point in my life. It's not all in the eye of the beholder. If you put a building that is well designed next to one that has no thought put into it at all, everyone will be able to look and say, "That's beautiful, that's ugly." Now, between the two, there may be a range of opinions and tastes. We're not saying there isn't that. But beauty is something God has given us a deep ability to appreciate. And it's something wonderful. It's why poetry is underestimated in the Bible and in its function in our lives. And art and all of the beautiful things in God's creation You don't have to be culturally sophisticated to enjoy these things. Beauty is everywhere around us. And it's part of what it means to be the image of God, that we can perceive it like no other creature. And then reason. The way, and here, we're not just talking about rules of logic. That's certainly a wonderful part of reason. We're talking about all of our mental abilities to understand. They are a combination of logic and intuition. And there's a mysterious dimension to this, but we are able to size up the world and come to an understanding of things. God has given us this ability. We are able to know Him truly, if not exhaustively. And we are able to know truth and discern it from falsehood. We are able to write books and preach sermons and have intelligent conversation with one another. Something that's fast disappearing, all of those things actually are, but they'll never completely disappear. Why? Because we're made in God's image. We're intelligent creatures. And as hard as that may be at times to define, we know precisely what we mean. And all the creations around us, it's laughable when we think that perhaps chimpanzees, given the right amount of time, might create anything, even a tiny whisper of the culture that we participate in. If you think about what it is that mankind, even in a fallen situation, has been able to develop over the centuries of our existence, the millennia of our existence, it's astonishing. But it's because we're made in the image of God. And I want to conclude this by saying that our being God's image, and that means the totality of what we are, is as mysterious as God in whose image we are made. Now note that, because it's going to be a theme at our bioethics conference. We have been hearing tales of how science now, having discovered the existence of the genome map, will be able to figure out everything about human beings. And in fact, it is the assumption of many that we will be reduced to physical reality purely. And that's a lie. And in fact, I'm not troubled by this project, because I think it is a magnificent revelation of God, the detailed code which is required for us to function at the physical level, which is present in our human natures, is utterly remarkable. And I tell you, we will never plumb the depths, because when we get down to the bottom of the billions and billions of bits of information, we will still be stymied, because nothing will be able there to identify our worshipfulness, our intelligence, our love and perception of beauty, and a whole range of things which are only attributed to our spiritual aspect. And so we are mysterious. We are, as David said, fearfully and wonderfully made. And we ought to stand in awe. It is, however, the quest of fallen man in his autonomy, in his saying what Adam said in the garden, that he really could take control of his own life, thank you very much, that we will control our lives and our destinies. And the Christian says, oh, no, you will not, because that quest for control will end in tragedy. And it will end in the ultimate tragedy of utter darkness for eternity. That's where that quest will end. It's called in the Bible idolatry, and it's interesting that the word image, which is carve or mold, is used positively only with this reference to God's image. Everywhere else, it has to do with men and women trying to make idols, substitute gods of their own imaginations. And so, we need to bow before this majestic mystery that God has revealed, that we are His image. And then male and female, we won't go into this in great detail, but there in 27b, we have this wonderful statement that male and female, now what's really mysterious about this is that men and women are the same, we're image of God, equal in imaging God, and yet there's a difference. And so what the way I would put it, and we'll unpack this in a couple of weeks, is that there is a complementary imaging in partnership to fulfill the mandate of taking dominion over the earth. Complementary. That is a necessary and beautiful partnership. So there's a difference. we're rediscovering this, according to John Stossel and others who are saying, there's a difference between men and women, you know, it's a marvelous insight into the obvious. But there is. In our culture, though, because of the corruption caused by evolutionary thinking, it really believes that there's not a difference. Much of it does. And so we need to take that seriously. We can chuckle in a way, and yet there's a serious tragedy underneath our laughter. And so we are made to be social beings, to have family and society. And as we undermine those distinctions between male and female, we undermine the whole fabric of human culture. I'll leave you with that thought on that subject, and we'll pick up again in several weeks when we get into chapter 2. But now the second point here is that God not only created man, we're going to have three C's that you can remember here, but he commanded man to cultivate all of his creation. To cultivate. I was just stayed overnight when I was up at a presbytery meeting on Friday evening with a farmer who was also a Reformed elder and a wonderful man. And he took me around his farm and I took pictures of it. And it's a great farm. These old New England farmers, you know, have 25 vehicles. And there are all these vehicles and all these contraptions that you hook to tractors to get bale hay and to separate it and to collect it and all the rest of it. And it was wonderful to see that because there is in a most fundamental way, someone who is subduing the earth to God's glory. He's extracting the riches of God's creation from one simple thing. Hay. That's all he does. And he does have a little vegetable garden. But we have, as part of our being the image, and it's innate to us. It's not like, well, now you're the image of God, and here, let's see, I'll give you something to do. No. It's part and parcel of what it means to be the image of God that we are made to create. And I don't care what it is, whether it's to paint a picture, to write a poem, to write a song, to build a cabinet, to fix your car, or to invent a car. All of those things are part of our being creative, and we fulfill, therefore, a cultural mandate. And, of course, to be fruitful and multiply means that we are also to continue the human race. We are to be making children in the family. We are to be continuing history so that God could bring all of his elect people into the world to save them, to be a great multitude at the end of history. And, of course, another thing that Cass gets into in his critique of the modern situation is the what ought to be horrific possibility that people, without being married and without ever having sexual relations or any intimate personal relationship with someone of the opposite sex, can have children that are created in test tubes or implanted in the wombs of women. And that's, you see, a denial, a most radical denial of what it means to be created in God's image and to be given this command to be fruitful and multiply. And it's a radical undermining that is, in fact, threatening our very civilization. If you don't know it already, we are in a brave new world. We're in it. It's happening. As we see the debates about cloning, as we see various debates about removing life support systems from people who are considered to be brain dead, we are in the brave new world, and we need to take advantage of that by being clear about what we believe that God has commanded men and women to do in taking dominion over the creation of God. James makes this interesting statement when he's talking about the taming of the tongue. He says, "For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind." Now here, of course, he is really applying this. You can't tame your tongue. You can tame a lion, but you can't tame your tongue. There's something wrong here, folks. And of course, we know that the entrance of sin has enabled us or has made us to have tongues that are like wildfire, that burn up those around us. And yet, we continue to tame animals. And that's another way of saying we still take dominion over God's creation because we were made to do that. And we need to affirm that, and we need to recognize that even the unbeliever is continuing that project so that history will continue and that God even gets glory, though not acknowledged, by the creations of the unbeliever, because it shows that we, in fact, are His. To be the image of God means that we are under His lordship. He claims us as His own. We are responsible to Him whether we acknowledge it or not. That's what it means to be created by God and commanded to have dominion. Because we were meant, of course, to create all that we create so that His name will be magnified, so that we will appreciate and then show to others how wonderful God truly is. And you know, our image, the image being made in God's image, doesn't only reflect Him horizontally to others, but it reflects Him back to Himself. Now that's a profound thought that many theologians have had based on the Word of God. But imagine what that means, that He enjoys our taking this royal dominion and bringing the beauties and the wonderful things that we are able to bring, everything from vegetables to computers, out of the earth that He has given us as our dominion. What is man, says the psalmist, that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? And then he gives the answer to that. Of course, he's saying, how can you take notice of us? And then, of course, he says, under God's inspiration, because we're God's image, though he doesn't use the word image here. He says, what is man? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the work of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep, oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fishes of the sea that pass through the paths of the seas. But how we have failed to do this. How we have failed to glorify God. And even as Christians, how often do we enjoy His creation without really bringing Him the glory and the honor, without bowing before Him and saying, Lord, how wonderful You are. How excellent is Your name in all the earth. And of course, when we do this, and we often do, how often, even in this summer, have you been out in the world doing something, enjoying some recreational time, and been able to say, Lord, how excellent is Your name in all the earth, and be reminded every time you say that, if it were not for someone else who fulfills Psalm 8 and this creation mandate, you would never be able to do that. And who is that? It's Jesus Christ. And in fact, if you'll notice, the writer of Hebrews picks up on this very language that you have put all things under His feet. And he says, but this one who has come, the brightness of the glory of God Himself, who is incarnate and who came to be your high priest, to die in your place for sins, who was made a little lower than angels but now exalts you above them, we don't yet see all things put under His feet. Why does he say that? Because he knows that the dominion commanded here in Genesis is not fulfilled in this wicked, fallen, sinful, unthankful world. It will only be fulfilled in the Lamb at the end of history. And there, if you think we will not be active, you don't understand this command. We are not going to be sitting in pews singing hymns. We will sing. I am quite sure of that. But we will be engaged in a multitude of activities that will bring glory to God and fulfill this creation mandate. And in fact, as Christians, we begin to do this now in all that we do. And we will bring it to its fullness, the fullness of an eternal Sabbath in the new heavens and the new earth. Finally, God commended His creation to man in verses 29 to 31. He sees, He commends it to him. He says, see, I've given you everything. Now use it for my glory. And God saw all that He had made, and it was very good. And that was the end of the sixth day. And this is His commending. So He has created man out of nothing in His image. He has commanded us to take dominion for His glory over all of His creation. And now He commends the whole of the universe to us, to our care, and so that we may appreciate the goodness and the greatness of God. Everything is there. It's interesting that the word Adam is simply the Hebrew word for dirt. That's humbling. Ought to be. But it's also dirt that is capable of cultivation. Well, that's encouraging. And then Adam then becomes, of course, a proper name because of the historical person who was created out of the dust by the breath of God and made the first man and then woman out of his side. And so, we are reminded that the man of dust is now the one who takes the dust and cultivates it for God's glory. And this is our task. And this is what we should remember to be, that we are have commended to us all that God has given to us in His world. And all very good. Here, good, it's not, that wasn't a surprise to God, as we said last week. Oh, that's good. No. He designed it to be good. And what He is doing is saying now to us, it's suitable. Everything I've made is suitable to my grand purposes of making for me a people, for us a people. And that we, you should be for us a people as triune God, and that we should be to you God, Lord, Master, and lover of your souls. And that's the grand project of which we are wonderfully a part. It is good. Everything is good that God has created. And it's interesting then that Paul picks up on that word good, and we don't often think of it this way, but he says, all things work together for good. All things, even the things, and especially the things that don't seem to be working very well for us in this world, God makes them work for good, because in the new creation, He is going to get glory to His name through us. And He will. And we can be sure of that. Why? Because His Son has restored the creation order through us by redeeming us and saving us. Now you say, well, wait, He has restored it? Yes. It's all done in His resurrection. But now He is fulfilling that mandate by continuing history up to the end when it will all be realized in its fullness. In a sense, all things are under His feet, but not yet in terms of the realm. Okay? We don't have the kingdom, the territory, the acreage that we will inherit in the new heavens and the new earth. But we already begin to subdue the earth to God's glory. And I believe, brothers and sisters, that there are two things that we need to do. We need to, first of all, be thankful to God and praise Him. I hope you have a sense of the thrill when we sing these hymns of how great God is and what a privilege to sing to Him. Even the hymns themselves and the words themselves are creations. They are reflective that we are made in God's image as a worshiping people. And do not let the technological civilization in which we live, which has many blessings, we all know about those, but sometimes we let that rob us of a sense of the glory of God in His world. We let it rob us of that sense of wonder. We think, oh, how is this made? Where is the formula? How many bits and bytes is this made up of? Or genome bits or whatever. That's fine. But stand back from it. And as they say, smell the roses. And stand back from it and think about what God has made you and redeemed you to be. We do not do this enough, brothers and sisters, and we need to do it. It's one of the reasons why I believe that recreation and vacations are important, because it stops us from the tremendous, sometimes overwhelming, is there any wonder why we have high blood pressure in our culture? Overwhelming pressure of organization, of maintenance in our culture. It overwhelms us so that we are blinded to God's image and His wonder, and we need to step back from it. And vacations, thankfully, slow us down. Or just times apart. You don't have to go anywhere or even spend any money to stop and relax and enjoy a sense of the wonder of God's creation and that you are made in His image to be able to enjoy it. The second thing is that we are to defend, preserve, and exhibit true humanity. By defending, I mean we need to enter into loving, intelligent discussion with people who think we are nothing but highly developed animals, and we need to show them how wrong they are from their own experience, from the revelation that's right there for you to work with, and then, especially, from this special revelation, which gives us the corrective lenses by which we can truly see the world as God meant us to see it. And then we need to preserve it. It's always been odd to me that oftentimes conservative Christians are great defenders of those who ruin the earth. How can we be that? How can we be defending the creation of acres and acres of asphalt and more cars which have undermined the whole fabric of our culture in so many ways? How can we be in favor of this just without thinking? It's obvious that we're not doing a lot of thinking about it. Because, in fact, it's terrible stewardship. I really enjoy automobiles. You probably, some of you know that. I enjoy driving. I enjoy everything about their aesthetics and the whole business. But I think that we don't understand what we're doing. We're not good ecologists. And those around us who are maybe on the other side of the aisle politically, we could learn something from them. We need to be careful how arrogant we can be as conservative Christians when we fail to defend a real stewardship of God's world. We need to rethink some of these things. There are a lot of good Christians, very bright Christians, who are thinking about these things. And if you want some things to read on these subjects, I'd be happy to give you the bibliography. But we need to do much better. We're not against business or development, but it must be done with respect for God and His creation. And it may, in fact, have we ever thought about this, that green person that's out there, and we like to call them tree huggers, out there hugging trees, that instead of holding up our placard against them, that if we would go and stand next to the tree and explain lovingly that the tree is God's creation. And yes, we respect it with them, but for a different reason. And have you ever considered this? We need to engage people in that way. And then we can always bring them to the fact that the reason that the world is in such a ruin is because we need the gospel. We need the Christ who alone has fulfilled and pleased God in fulfilling the creation mandate. And so we need to also demonstrate, finally, a true love for our neighbor. That is what we are called to do in Christ, to imitate Him. We are predestined to be conformed to the image of the Son, and He is the one who came into this world and died for sinners such as we are, so that we could enjoy His world for eternity. And we need to demonstrate that same love to our poor neighbor who is not destined for the same if he doesn't know the gospel.